Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news and begin in a moment and speak with Stephen Cohen, who's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, where he specializes on India, Pakistan, and South Asian security issues. We'll be obviously talking about the 2.5-day siege of Mumbai and the political fallout that is expected to affect India-Pakistan relations, which were beginning to thaw. The foreign minister of Pakistan happened to be in India at the time of this attack. And we'll talk in a moment with Stephen Cohen about those issues, as well as Chris Fair, who is a senior political scientist at the RAND Corporation, formerly is a South Asia specialist at the United States Institute of Peace. She also speaks Hindi and Urdu has met with some of the terrorist groups at whom the fingers are being pointed. So we'll be talking to both these specialists in a moment. And then we'll speak with Winslow Wheeler, who's worked on national security issues for 31 years with members of the United States Senate and the General Accounting Office. He is one of the senior officials on the staff of the Senate Budget Committee, on the Republican staff, working for a number of senators. And he's now a senior fellow and director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Center for Defense Information. And we'll be talking to him about the national security team that's expected to be announced on Monday and the extent to which the Pentagon budget will, how you could fit in the Pentagon budget in terms of the overall economic distress that the economy is experiencing in this financial meltdown that continues. I'm now speaking with Stephen Cohen, who's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He specializes in analysis of India, Pakistan, and South Asian security issues. Previously was a professor of political science and history and founder director of the program in arms control, disarmament, and international security at the University of Illinois Urbana. He was a member of the policy planning staff of the U.S. Department of State from 1985 to 1987 and is the author of a number of books, including The Idea of Pakistan and India, Emerging Power. And Stephen Cohen, obviously, having the foreign minister of Pakistan visit India at the very moment that this terrorist attack in Mumbai took place has led many analysts to speculate that perhaps there are elements inside Pakistan that were not too happy with the thawing of relationships between India and Pakistan. Also, the extent to which the new president of Pakistan, Zardari, asserted that recently that India did not pose a threat to Pakistan and offering to repudiate the first use of nuclear weapons. Can you give us a sense of whether this speculation is in any way grounded?
Yes, Ian, I think it, and good morning to you and to my LA friends. I think that there's an element of truth to that. It's not that this terrorist attack was planned while the foreign minister was there, but he was there because it's part of a larger trend between Zardari and his government and the Indian government, although movement was going very, very slowly. Personally, I don't think that they would have concluded anything for a long time. Indians are in no rush to reach an agreement with Pakistan, which is part of the problem. And of course, the Pakistan government can't speak for Pakistan because it has to drag the Pakistan army along with it. And I think that there's good evidence now that this attack was aimed at this peace process, this dialogue between India and Pakistan, as well as larger issues, and those issues pertain to the American relationship with Pakistan, our new relationship with India, and our whole situation in Afghanistan. So this could brew up into a larger crisis affecting the domestic politics of both India and Pakistan. We have two weak governments, and also our position in Afghanistan. So it's a present to Barack Obama as he becomes president. You know, here's a new crisis for you right off the bat.
And of course, Vice President predicted something off the cuff during the election campaign for which he was taken to the woodshed. Whether or not this is a deliberate testing of the president-elect, I guess, is another matter. But there is a thought or a rumor that the president-elect Obama had an overall plan since he, a part of his election campaign was to suggest that Afghanistan was really the, should be the focus of our foreign policy. Iraq was a mistake, a war that should never have been fought and authorized, but we dropped the ball in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, and he's there's a suggestion that perhaps he was thinking of a diplomatic initiative over Kashmir that would, if there were some kind of a ceasefire and a rapprochement between India and Pakistan, that that kind of deployment of those forces on that border would be, therefore be, you could move some of the Indian forces to the west, to the territories, to perhaps help the United States out. In since we appear to be mired in Afghanistan, is there anything to that scenario?
Well, that's correct, and that was the game plan of Barack Obama and a lot of his advisors. And the, I think the problem was that it was too much too late. In a sense, if you approach India through Pakistan and Pakistan through Afghanistan, you're really not dealing with their major concerns. And the Indian major Indian concern has been Pakistan and the notion that we can somehow persuade the Indians to normalize and have a good relationship with Pakistan, so Pakistan, in turn, can help us in Afghanistan, was a logical argument, but in fact, it was easily disrupted by this terrorist attack. And I think this attack was part of the al-Qaeda pattern. Whether or not al-Qaeda was involved in this, I don't know, but when Senator Biden said there was going to be an attack, he was echoing the belief that al-Qaeda usually times its attacks before or during a transition period. And in this case, the transition period is both here and also in India. India is entering into a major election in the next couple of months by May of next year, and this is certainly going to hurt the chances of the Congress Party of getting reelected, Prime Minister Manmohan Singh. It also, is a blow against a very weak, although democratically elected, civilian government in Pakistan. So it's a multi-purpose attack. It embarrasses the Americans. It hurts the Indians. It provokes might provoke another India-Pakistan crisis, and it demonstrates that Lashkar-e-Taiba or al-Qaeda or whatever coalition put this together is still alive and well.
So does that mean that, that India and Pakistan, even if the efforts at a rapprochement have been exaggerated and they're far more difficult than meets the eye, do they therefore have to be as counterintuitive as we appear to have been, at least the Bush administration, in their response to 9/11? In many ways, you could argue that President Bush has been the gift that keeps on giving to bin Laden.
Well, I'd set aside the whole question of whether our strategy towards al-Qaeda and bin Laden was right. I don't think it has been. But in this case, he opted to have a major strategic initiative with India. And I thought I supported the initiative, you know, essentially the India-U.S. nuclear agreement. I thought it made sense, and we should have done that much earlier. But in doing that, what happened was that he alienated and embittered the Pakistan Army, which still regards India as its major threat, while trying to get the Pakistan Army to be more proactive in the Northwest Frontier and Fatah. So one interpretation of this whole attack could be that the Pakistan Army or elements of the army, ISI, or some of the security, you know, some of the terrorist groups in Pakistan who favor this view, wanted to make sure that Pakistan would not pursue the war against Islamic extremists in Fatah, and would continue to support the Taliban, but would then reorganize its military strategy again towards India. They've been forced to pull out 5 or 6 divisions against the Indians and move them to Fatah. And that was an unpleasant experience for the Pakistan Army. There's a lot of complaints in Pakistan that Pakistan is being forced to ease its defenses against India. And I think you can argue that this attack was designed to provoke another crisis between India and Pakistan.
And Fatah is the federally administrated territory
on the
west that's sort of something of a no-man's land from which the Taliban seem to be able to strike at will into Afghanistan, and which is also the territory where al-Qaeda is rumored to be sheltered.
Probably hold up there, yeah.
Yes. So obviously there are already signs with India within the Indian polity that suggests that what you just said earlier is in fact underway. Some of the BJP officials, Modi and Advani, are making a comeback, or at least grandstanding. Are there any voices of moderation that can say, wait a minute, we're falling into the hands of these people if this is indeed a provocation, so that we do what the bad guys want, let's not fall into that trap.
Well, yeah, I think some Indians are making that argument, but the Indian military and security bureaucracy demonstrated a high degree of incompetence in this case. And I think the government is legitimately criticized for not having taken this threat seriously enough or not, perhaps not organized itself properly to deal with it. Now, Modi himself is another case. I won't get into the details. But he's a man who criticized bitterly one of the anti-terrorist officers, and now after his death is praising him to the skies. It turns out that there were elements of the Indian Army, at least one or two officers, who may have been supporting Hindu extremists. So this links up, this whole thing links into India's identity as a secular state and the classical Hindu-Muslim rivalry within India as well as between India and Pakistan.
So to what extent is there a blurred line between Hindu extremism and Hindu terrorism?
There have been a number of events in India which have been provoked by or organized by the extremist Hindu right. India is replete with all kinds of terrorist activities, and ranging from Maoists to Islamic groups which have sprung up, and Hindu groups. The Islamic groups that have sprung up, several of them, and one of them may well have been involved in this, are generally regarded as a direct response to Hindu extremism. You know, India's had pogroms against Muslims, both in North India and in South India, mostly North India, and in Gujarat, Modi's own state, over the past 10, 15 years. So I think that's an element of increasing radicalism in India. You know, all of this, of course, contradicts the notion of a shining India or an emerging India. It's the dirty underbelly of India. India is both an emerging democracy and an emerging economy that also has a great deal of homegrown violence.
And Stephen Cohen, obviously there's a lot of speculation throughout this three-day ordeal on television, and it continues. So, you know, at the risk of saying something that is not supported later by the facts, one thing that seems to be at least clear to me is that it's shall we say, highly coincidental that two of the victims of this attack were the head of counterterrorism and the chief of police in Mumbai. Is it, and there hasn't been much reporting on this, were these two individuals targeted?
No, I don't think so. I think they volunteered early on to go in, not realizing how well organized and how disciplined the terrorists were. So they charged in there without adequate equipment, without adequate intelligence, and essentially with the first shot. Now, they may have been trapped in an ambush there. I suspect that this terrorist group was extremely well organized. I suspect they planned to trap, knowing that some brave Indian officers would lead the way, and of course they were caught and killed. Actually, they lost three senior officers right away, right off the bat.
And why was there such an extraordinary delay between the first responders and the deaths of these top men and the arrival of the elite forces, the Black Cats? It seemed
the National Security Force is located in Agra, and by the time they got an airplane to fly them down to Delhi, the total trip took 9 hours. There were no units based in the Bombay area, nor are there units based in, say, Hyderabad or any of the other major Indian cities. So they're concentrated in Agra. And the plane was elsewhere. The plane was in Punjab and Chandigarh. Had to fly and pick them up after being refueled. Then a slow plane had to fly them down to Bombay. So that took 9 hours. And by that time, as these things go, you know, that's an eternity.
And equally slow was the assault on the Jewish center. The first reports were when that young surviving son of the rabbi came out with the housekeeper. There was a report that the hostages in that building, so-called hostages, were all dead. So what happened there? That assault took 10 hours.
Well, there in that case, they waited for some for the group from Agra to come down. You know,
oh, I see.
This kind of activity, but the local Bombay police and the Maharashtrian state police, Bombay's in Maharashtra state, did not have the training or the technology to do it. They simply don't have the manpower, and I think you can fault the Indian government. The Indian government will be faulted for not adequately preparing for this. The other breakdown was, of course, some of these individuals may have come in by the sea. And while there was warning, sort of theoretical warning in the intelligence circles of a sea attack, and that there was some evidence that Lashkar-e-Taiba had a naval wing, like this, like the Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka, that an assault from the sea may take place. There was not adequate surveillance. Indian Coast Guard and Indian Navy probably have something to say, something help probably be held accountable for that.
And I think it's there are also reports that some of the terrorists were already in that hotel, the Taj.
Yeah, we don't know everything, but it could be that some of them had lived there for a couple of days, sort of stockpiling weapons and food and ammunition. And also, certainly what they did was that they knew the lay of the land better than the police did. I saw an interview on Indian television, which is streaming live all over the place now, and the officer in charge was praising the terrorists for having much better information about the Taj Mahal Hotel than he did. So they knew the byways, they knew the back alleys, they knew the corridors much better than the police were attacking. So that's evidence that, in fact, that they had set themselves up and were well organized to deal with an expected police assault. My guess is that you'll see that, like the 9/11 attack, there were probably a mastermind or a group outside of South Asia, either Al-Qaeda or Lashkar-e-Taiba or a coalition of these groups. And at the second tier, there were probably operatives there who directed the foot soldiers, as in Al-Qaeda, the 9/11 attacks. A lot of them were simply recruited as muscle men. They were the guys who stormed the cockpit. But some of the brains behind it had a lot of training in flying airplanes and organization. So I suspect this is that kind of graded competence that you'll see of the different participants once they sort this all out.
Well, the owner of the hotel, Tata, of the Taj, said they came in the back. I don't know whether there was just literally... I mean, there's been a lot of complaints about the lack of security, and apparently there was some extra security put in the hotels and then taken out. But the long and the short of it is, what's the point of it if somebody can come in the back door?
Well, I've stayed there, and it's literally a 100-plus-year-old hotel. I was there earlier this year, in fact. And while the front entrance is carefully guarded and there was some screening of luggage, there were a lot of side entrances to it, a huge, enormous hotel, more than a city block large. And somebody inside could have easily opened up a door and allowed people to come in the back door.
So, Stephen Cohen, again, back to the sort of central speculation here about who's behind this attack. And simply because it appears to be aimed at thwarting efforts on the part of the new government in Pakistan to at least thaw their relationships and perhaps ease the tensions on that border and perhaps redeploy some troops to deal with the resurgent Taliban. What gets thrown into the mix here in speculation is ISI, the Inter Service Intelligence Agency of the Pakistani Army, which has a reputation of duplicity, whether it's earned or not. Again, are they as duplicitous as we're told that there's rogue elements? Or, I mean, there was a bit of a flap here where the Pakistan government suggested they were going to send the head of ISI over to India to reassure them, and then apparently they, at the last minute, they said they reneged on that promise and sent a junior officer.
Yeah, well, they don't have control over the army and the ISI itself. You know, they're civilian politicians. They have some legitimacy, but clearly the army sees itself as the ultimate guarantor of India, of Pakistani security, and the ISI within the army, or it's actually an inter-services organization, sees itself as the last bastion of security for Pakistan. And these officers, you know, for their own legitimate reasons, do not believe that normalization with India is proper. Now, whether some of them went ahead and actually looked the other way while this project was underway, I can't tell you, but I think it looks like an Al-Qaeda operation. It looks like a Lashkar-e-Taiba operation. My guess is it'll turn out to be a coalition of two or three, maybe even four different organizations, all of which wanted to disrupt India-Pakistan relations. The Indian side, they may have been an Indian radical Muslim group who's simply angry at the Hindu extremist in India, and all of them would share their concern or hatred of the United States and the West. And I think they picked out an Israeli or a Jewish center to make that point very strongly.
Well, just in closing, Stephen Cohen, there were apparently talks between the U.S. military intelligence heads and the Pakistani military and intelligence heads, and supposedly, according to reports recently in the Washington Post by Walter Pincus, that things were actually... there was some improvement in relations and more cooperation, particularly in terms of stopping the infiltration of the Taliban into Afghanistan and making a more concerted effort against al-Qaeda. I don't understand, though, at the end of the day, how we can make any kind of lasting deal. We certainly can't succeed in that part of the world unless we have the cooperation of the Pakistanis, and that doesn't appear to be the case. They don't appear to, there appears to be some ambivalence over whether they really want us to stabilize Afghanistan under this Karzai government. And the argument is that we're not giving them any strategic incentive since India has a presence in there. And you recall recently there was a bombing of an Indian consulate that resulted in a large number of deaths, and the finger was pointed at ISI's involvement in that.
Yeah, I think that's an absolutely correct analysis. The Army still worries about encirclement by India. But the Army knows that because Pakistan is a nuclear power, nobody can really touch it, and that's one of the, that's their ace in the hole, that if there's a crisis between India and Pakistan, you'll see the Americans rushing in, you'll see the Brits rushing in, maybe the Chinese urging them to cool it. So the Pakistan Army knows that it can conduct a low-level intensity warfare against India under the shadow of a nuclear weapon. And the Indians are frozen by this. And the Indians, of course, don't want to engage in a crisis which might escalate to nuclear war. So in a sense, we're all trapped. And I think the core problem is the difficulty of Pakistan cohering as a state. It is really beginning to come apart at the seams. And if it didn't have the nuclear weapons, I think we'd be in there in a flash or allow the Indians to break it up. But the nuclear weapons do protect Pakistan. And, of course, Pakistan does have a potential for emerging out of this as a normal state. But I think this is a giant step backward as far as that hope is concerned.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles.
Okay.
Stephen.
Bye-bye.
Cohen. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. So speaking then with Stephen Cohen, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, who specializes in study and analysis of India, Pakistan, and South Asian security issues. Previously a professor of political science and history and the founder director of the program in arms control, disarmament, international security at the University of Illinois, Urbana. He's also was a member of the policy planning staff of the United States State Department from 1985 to 1987 and the author of a number of books, including The Idea of Pakistan and India, Emerging Power. I'm now speaking with Chris Fair, who's a senior political science at the RAND Corporation, was formerly a South Asia specialist at the United States Institute of Peace. And you go to the region a lot, Chris Fair, and just to follow on from what Stephen Cohen was saying, is it really that stark that nuclear weapons hold Pakistan together?
Well, I'm not actually sure that that's what Steve Cohen meant to suggest. I think what Steve Cohen meant to suggest was something similar, but not exactly that, namely that Pakistan can really pursue a variety of policies because its nuclear weapons provided immunity from response. So, for example, after the introduction of, the overt nuclearization of the subcontinent in 1998, Pakistan actually got more brazen in its support for asymmetric conflict in India, secure in the knowledge that India's ability to respond conventionally would be restrained by nuclearization, and the concept there being that no one, once conflict initiates, can be certain that they have escalation dominance. And so Pakistan could basically use the specter of escalation to nuclear war to basically preempt India's ability to respond conventionally. So what, in fact, nuclear weapons has afforded Pakistan in terms of its conduct of its relations with its neighbors is it can support these militant actors with relative confidence that a conventional response is not going to be forthcoming. It also, from the U.S. end, complicates the way we deal with Pakistan. We can't simply pursue a policy of sanctioning or a policy of containment to deal with the militant problem because we're also very concerned about Pakistan's past and possible future as a nuclear proliferator. So basically, nuclear weapons really provides Pakistan with a level of immunity that makes its neighbors and the United States, it puts us in a very difficult place in terms of coming up with appropriate policy responses to the problems emanating in and from Pakistan.
And Chris Fair, since so much of fingers are being pointed at a real or alleged role of the ISI, the Pakistani Army's intelligence and the extent to which they may be working in concert with some of these terrorist groups in this Lashkar-e-Taiba, which seems to be, again, the finger seems to be pointing in their direction. There is a history of some kind of relationships between Pakistani military intelligence and these terrorist groups. I take it the motive on the part of the Pakistani army to get into bed with them was it was essentially a way of fighting a war on the cheap.
Well, certainly fighting a war on the cheap is one way of phrasing it. I think the other possibility that's probably even more important is that it affords the Pakistanis a degree of plausible deniability. You know, in point of fact, there haven't been too many smoking guns presented when these groups that are based in Pakistan have operated in India. Remember in 2001, there was a very horrific attack on the Indian parliament. The allegations have generally focused upon Jaish-e-Mohammed. Others say that Lashkar-e-Taiba, working with Jaish, did this jointly. But there was never really any smoking gun that A, suggested that these groups were operating under the direct supervision of the IFI, and that attack enjoyed the sanction of Pakistan's apex leadership. And I think the same set of questions surround this attack. It is becoming clear that this was a Lashkar-e-Taiba attack. Some of the reporting here in the U.S., it turns out, hasn't been exactly accurate. There wasn't, for example, this was not a hostage situation. So I think some of the reporting here in the U.S. sort of obfuscated, certainly for me, the degree to which this was, in fact, a classic Lashkar operation. It does seem as if the attackers were Pakistani. They appear to have been speaking Punjabi. They do appear to be Lashkar. But even Indian analysts that I was speaking with this morning say that a couple of questions really loom large. One, even in the intercept traffic that they have, there's nothing that connects these particular operators to apex leadership of Lashkar-e-Taiba, which is Hafez Saeed, and there's nothing that links them to the ISI in any way, shape, or form. So just because the group is based in and from Pakistan does not necessarily mean that it enjoyed the sanction of the ISI, much less apex Pakistani leadership. But the interesting thing about Lashkar, unlike some of these other groups, Lashkar has actually not targeted the Pakistani state. It actually has not evidenced a lot of fracturing of its leadership. And so if we're going to believe that Lashkar completely operated independently of its ISI taskmasters, then we are looking at a very alarming set of developments. And so I think for this reason, a lot of people do suspect that Lashkar is not operating outside of some sort of chain of command with the ISI.
And you've met with some of these Lashkar people, haven't you?
Well, I've met the person that everyone has met, which is their PR guy. Lashkar sort of operates like, it kind of depends on the security environment in Pakistan and who they're allowed to meet with. But they actually do have a PR person whose job it is to meet with foreigners and sort of pass out the Lashkar-e-Taiba, now Jamaat-ul-Dawa party line. But I don't even think that Yahya Mujahid, who is the person I've met, and many of us, Jessica Stern has written about her meetings with him, he still wouldn't characterize himself as a Mujahid. He's their PR guy.
Mm-hmm. But when I said that the Pakistan army were recruited them as an army on the cheap, I thought that was largely a part of their strategy in Kashmir, as opposed to attacking soft targets inside India.
It's always been, Pakistan has relied upon a whole battery of militant groups to prosecute its policies in Afghanistan, in Indian-administered Kashmir, and then also within India itself. Lashkar is sort of an interesting group. I was talking this morning with Praveen Swami, who writes for The Hindu in India, also Frontline. He's actually, I think, done some of the best work on Lashkar in India. Lashkar has been able to establish Indian cadres. It has Indian commanders. And so you have this very formidable group with Pakistan origins, but it's also been able to forge very important ties within India. So much so that, even when this thing broke out, even Praveen initially thought that these were going to be homegrown militants and not Pakistani militants. And so some of the recent attacks that have taken place in India have been done by, I guess, what Praveen would call Indian Lashkar. So it is absolutely the case that Lashkar, like Jaish-e-Mohammed, like Harkat-ul-Jihad, Harkat-ul-Ansar, and a raft of other groups, including Hizb ul-Mujahideen and al-Badr, have been the groups that Pakistan's relied upon to prosecute its policies in India, as you say, a sort of jihad on the cheap, but also jihad by proxy because it provides plausible deniability. It's much more difficult for the Indian state to hold the Pakistani state accountable for these attacks when it's able to do so through proxies. But Lashkar, unlike some of the other groups, has been able to forge perhaps more Indian ties in recent years.
And to Stephen Cohen's overall point about the President-elect Obama's alleged strategy, which was to have a diplomatic initiative between India and Pakistan to ease tensions in Kashmir so that Pakistan could redeploy troops to help the U.S. out on the border with Afghanistan. Is that something that you accept as in the works?
Well, if that was in the works, and I'm certainly not privy to what the Obama administration is or is not doing, at first blush that seems like a very good idea, but certainly this attack makes that very difficult. We saw this in 2001-02. We wanted the Pakistanis a raid along the western border. The military crisis made it very difficult. They swung their troops east, and that's when many of the Taliban and al-Qaeda operatives were able to flee and take refuge into Pakistan. So it's a very desirable outcome, and it seems like a reasonable way to get that outcome. But there are a couple of things that make it difficult quite apart from this present crisis. It has become sort of the standard assumption here in Washington that what Pakistan is doing allegedly in Afghanistan and along its borders is driven by the fact that it has an unresolved border with India and a longstanding security competition with India. And so there's a lot of interest in so-called efforts to fix Pakistan's borders. My concern, though, is that in some sense, Pakistan's security competition with India sort of transcends its unresolved borders. India is going to be the preeminent power in South Asia in the future. Pakistan's ability to prosecute its interests in the region with a strong India are going to become much more restricted. And so my concern is that even if there were to be some sort of magical policy wand that fixed the borders, making Pakistan feel comfortable with its Indian neighbor is probably not going to be achieved by fixing borders alone. And I might add, fixing borders is not easy. Pakistan not only has this line of control with India that remains in dispute, its border with Afghanistan, the Durand Line, is also not resolved. But Pakistan has an existential fear of India that I think really transcends the Kashmir dispute at this juncture and is much more related to the trajectory of ascendance that India is really on, even though the ascendance has been much slower than some people had earlier anticipated.
So is the new president of Pakistan, Asif Ali Zardari, naive when he suggests that India does not represent a threat to Pakistan? Apparently that was not welcomed by the Pakistani military.
Well, I think Professor Cohen, you know, he was absolutely correct in his assessment. Zardari doesn't control the military. Zardari doesn't control the ISI. Zardari, like a lot of private citizens and public figures, would probably in some measure welcome better ties with India as well as with Afghanistan, because there's really a lot of business to be had. Economically, Pakistan would be benefited tremendously by normalized relations with its two neighbors, India and Afghanistan. But that being said, Zardari has absolutely no control over the military, and the military has some very perverse incentives. The military legitimizes both to its own ranks and officers, but also to the Pakistani people, that it has this presumed right to intervene in Pakistani governance because of this existential threat. So if this existential threat were to be removed, then some of the very arguments that the Pakistan Army offers to legitimize its incessant interference in the governance of the state would go away. And so it's not surprising that when there have been important civilian overtures to normalize relations, the Army's undermined it. You know, going back to 1999, when Nawaz Sharif, with then Indian Prime Minister Vajpayee, initiated the Lahore Declaration and the so-called bus diplomacy. While the Indian Prime Minister was making his way to Lahore on the bus for peace, In fact, the Pakistan Army was engineering a covert operation in the Indian Kargil draw sector that was so tightly held that even the DGISI wasn't involved. So in some sense, the Army is the real spoiler here. Now, I don't want to create some Panglossian idea that if, in fact, Pakistan were completely governed by civilians, that there would be a blossoming of peace in the region, because in point of fact, whenever you've had a return to civilian governance, in some measure, there has been some degree of support for Army's positions in Kashmir and Afghanistan among the civilians. It's a little bit too early to see what the real civilian position is in Pakistan, because, you know, in point of fact, the Army is still calling the shots on so many of these important issues.
But what you've just said, Chris Fair, leads the one to at least speculate that there was an incentive on the part of the Pakistan military to be the spoiler in this case, or if indeed that is their role. I mean, if they're not a part of the solution, they're a part of the problem in terms of bringing peace to that region.
Oh, I don't know too many people that would disagree with that formulation.
Mm-hmm. So what do we do? How do we reorient our policy, since our policy throughout the Bush administration's policy was to give Musharraf a blank check, and now we're begging the Pakistani military to help us out with this mess that we've got on our hands in Afghanistan. So I don't see us pivoting towards helping this weak civilian leadership in Pakistan.
Well, a couple of things about that. I mean, I think in general, it's a lot easier to poke holes in what we have done with Pakistan than it is to offer a lucid and clarion way forward. The United States really has to do what seems on the surface and in practice to be nearly impossible. We have to both simultaneously foster real democracy in Pakistan. That is not going to happen in 5 years. That's not going to happen probably in 10 years. That's a decades-long progress, or a decades-long process. And that happens by focusing on institutions like the judiciary, focusing on the parliament and the provincial assemblies, focusing on political parties, their ability to organize, to aggregate interest, to operate professionally, and to minimize patronage. I mean, this list goes on and on and on. The linchpin of those programs being successful is that we actually have a partner in Pakistan dedicated to change. By the way, I doubt that that exists. Two, it relies upon some strategic leadership in Washington that's willing to make a sort of commitment to the civilian institutions for the next several decades that we've made to the Pakistan military, which is we're going to invest in you to build up your capabilities. I always say we are always interested in expanding the IMET program for the Pakistan Army, and that's the International Military Education Training Program to build capacity in the Pakistan Army. I'm all the time asking, where's the IMET for civilian leadership? The other thing that the United States has to do in concert, which seems to be in contradiction to the first, and that is that it has to, at the same time that it buttresses democracy, it has to forge a better relationship with the Pakistan Army. For those, you know, who may look at the dollar figures that we've shoveled towards Pakistan since 9/11, it may surprise them to hear that we have more discordant relations with the Pakistan Army than we probably did on September 10th. The reason is we have a very transactional relationship with them. We have, through coalition support funds programming, given them large sums of money as reimbursements, although that program has been largely unchecked. It's probably fostered corruption in the Pakistan military rather than mitigated it. But we have, at the same time, have expected the Pakistan military to do things that it has not wanted to do and, indeed, that it finds to be against its interests. The Pakistan military did not relish turning on the Taliban, even though many within the military found that the Taliban was in some measure undermining Pakistan's own interests. The Pakistan military has not relished doing a U-turn on the Kashmir jihad, which is why some analysts have suggested that we would expect to see perhaps a return to business as usual now that Musharraf is gone, and the Pakistan Army has not relished engaging in operations against its own citizenry. So in some sense, while we've spent a lot of resources on the Pakistan Army, we've actually found ourselves in a position of equal, if not greater, hostility towards the United States within the Army as we did on September 10th. So the task is really, how do we build a better, more trust-based relationship with the military that focuses on expanding its counterinsurgency capabilities while at the same time building democracy? And that is, by no means, is that an easy task. And
well, just,
we haven't succeeded thus far, so...
Well, just in closing then, do you think, Chris Fair, that the bad guys are going to win in this case, that in other words, these faltering attempts at bringing about peace from a weak government in Pakistan, civilian government in Pakistan, and a weak government in India, are going to essentially the bad guys are going to get their way. That the hardliners in India, the BJP people, will take advantage of the situation and harden the positions, and that Zardari in Pakistan will be weakened and twisting in the wind.
Well, and I would add to that. I think that's probably not an inaccurate assessment. My fear is that at some point or another, what the United States and its partners are going to slowly come to realize that what we have with Pakistan is a containment problem. The United States can't fix Pakistan. Pakistan doesn't seem capable or interested in fixing itself. It does seem interested in pursuing a raft of policies that endanger, quite frankly, its own ability to survive as a modern state with peace and security, and it endangers the neighborhood. And so if the United States and the international community can't fix Pakistan and it can't fix itself, then what we're left with is a containment problem. How do we mitigate the various threats that emanate from that state? And that is not a pleasant policy question to pose.
I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles today, Chris Fair. Bye-bye. Again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Chris Fair, who is a senior political science at RAND and a former Southwest Asia specialist at the United States Institute of Peace. I'm now speaking with Winslow Wheeler, who worked on national security issues for 31 years for members of the United States Senate and the U.S. General Accounting Office. In 2002, Winslow Wheeler authored an essay under the pseudonym Spartacus called Congress's Reaction to the September 11th, 2001 Terrorist Attack, entitled Mr. Smith is Dead, No One Stands in the Way as Congress Lards Post September 11 defense bills with pork. When senators complained about Winslow Wheeler's criticism, he was invited to resign from his position with the Republican staff of the Senate Budget Committee. He's now a senior fellow and director of the Strauss Military Reform Project at the Center for Defense Information. He's also the author of the book, The Wastrels of Defense, How Congress Sabotages U.S. Security. And given that President-elect Obama is supposed to announce his full national security team on Monday, we pretty much know all the slots, don't we, Winslow Wheeler, except the director of Central Intelligence. And I'm not sure about whether or not a president-elect will want some assistant secretaries in there, given that he's holding over Robert Gates.
Right. Thank you for having me on your show. I appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, thank you.
The theme of this transition for national security seems to be the word continuity. That's the Washington, D.C. way of finding an elegant term for what we are more familiar with as business as usual. The last thing we need is business as usual, especially in the Pentagon. I'm really surprised that President Obama, who campaigned so successfully and unmistakably about change, is quite literally going out of his way to embrace business as usual in the Pentagon. And I haven't a clue where Senator Clinton is going to take the State Department. I'm not sure if she does either.
So in terms of business as usual, does that mean that President-elect Obama is not going to put in his people under Gates, particularly, for example, is Edelman still in there?
I don't believe. No, he's not.
He's not. But so are there any of the vestiges of the neoconservatives that basically had pretty much had the whole?
They'll be gone. I'm not referring to that when I say business as usual.
Mm-hmm.
I'm referring to the decades in the Pentagon where our forces have constantly gotten smaller, on average older, and in key combat forces less ready to fight. We are literally today at a post-World War II high in terms of spending in inflation-adjusted dollars. But we're at a post-World War II low in the terms of the size of our Army, Navy, Air Force, and our major equipment is, on average, older than it's ever been before. It's a real disaster in terms of fundamental management in the Pentagon, It's not something that was brought to us just by Donald Rumsfeld and his rather incredible incompetence, but he was handed all these trends alive and well, all of them, by the Clinton Pentagon. And when I say business as usual, I'm referring not just to Secretary of Defense Gates. It's immaterial almost whether Obama changes people at the undersecretary and assistant secretary level, and he surely will. The problem is that the people he seems queued up to bring into the Pentagon are people who held similar positions during the Pentagon era, and they either were unaware of these problems, but most of them were aware of the problems and did nothing about them. And I'm not at all optimistic that these people have had a change or an epiphany to resolve themselves to show the bureaucratic spine it'll take to get us off the disastrous course the Pentagon has been on for a long, long time.
And just to get, for the benefit of the audience, to get clarification on this disastrous course where the Pentagon's been on, Winslow Wheeler, you're suggesting that all the money is going to the toys and not to the boys, and that they're getting older and less well-equipped as their equipment grinds down, particularly because of being in these expensive and costly wars, and particularly the Iraq War, which obviously is not going to end in any kind of victory, meaningful victory. So what's happening to all this money? I mean, you know, and then, of course, you've got to get to the next question, which we'll have to address, is how the hell are they going to get the kind of money they've been getting out of the till for forever, given our dire economic straits? But just start with the first one. What's going on here if less money is and less, there are less soldiers and less equipment for these soldiers than ever, but more money's being spent? So where's all that money going?
Well, we're paying more and getting less, not just in hardware, but people too. We're paying inflation-adjusted all-time highs for our people. Some of that is things that we are well advised to spend, like for veterans care, for these people returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, with things we really want to address. Some of the people issues are training that we should be spending more on, but some of the other people issues are issues like Congress lavishing on double retirement benefits for old-time veterans, increasing survivor benefits for the relatives of veterans. These are highly politically popular. They're also extremely expensive, and they make it harder to spend money for the kinds of things we need to spend money on. On hardware, a classic example is the aircraft the Air Force is hot to buy these days. The F-22, their top-of-the-line fighter, the total program unit cost is $355 million for each airplane. It's replacing the top-of-the-line aircraft that was designed in the 70s, the F-15. Its sticker price these days is about $65, $70 million. The low-cost new airplane, the Joint Strike Fighter, the F-35, is just beginning its cost growth stage. It's already at $180 million per airplane, and it's replacing the F-16 that, when we bought it in numbers, is about $30 million per aircraft in today's dollars. If you look at the performance of these airplanes, the F-22 is a huge disappointment, and the F-35, the so-called affordable Joint Strike Fighter, is a technical failure. It's a real kludge, and has no business being bought by any serious Air Force.
So why do we have a military industrial complex at Eisenhower warned us about back in 1960, that gets all the lion's share of the money, but doesn't deliver the goods. I mean, we're not even talking about whether you need these fighters and these submarines and all these destroyers and in this age of subnational and transnational conflict and asymmetrical warfare. I'm just saying, wait a minute, what they're making is no damn good, let alone bankrupting us.
Well, sometimes it's no damn good, sometimes it's irrelevant. The F-22 hasn't flown a single sortie, combat or otherwise, in the skies of Iraq or Afghanistan for the perfectly sensible reason that is completely irrelevant to that conflict. Your question is a complicated one, though. To try to keep it simple, we're buying these overpriced, irrelevant, poorly performing complexities because we're failing to pay attention to what really makes a difference in combat. We're paying attention instead to what makes a difference for the politicians on Capitol Hill and in the Pentagon. We're paying more attention to bureaucratic imperatives for let's add this and that and everything else to this design, to internal Pentagon politics. We're paying attention to all the wrong things. We're not paying attention to what makes a real difference in combat.
And when you have front page stories in Sunday's New York Times of Barry McCaffrey as a kind of poster boy for the revolving door, you mentioned bureaucrats, you mentioned politicians in both in the Pentagon and in the Congress. But the beneficiaries of all this money are the contractors, aren't they? And the extent to which they're able to get these front men like Barry McCaffrey.
Well, I don't blame the contractors. They're doing what they're paid to do. They're making money for their stockholders and for their profit margins for their firm. They're doing what they're supposed to do. I blame instead the people like General McCaffrey and the people. We can reorganize the Pentagon to the cows come home and pretend we're streamlining things or whatever. We won't change a damn thing unless we change the way people think. Sometimes that requires changing the people. Sometimes that requires giving the most, the people new leadership so they understand what they're really there for and stop paying attention to less important things.
So the contractors are the beneficiaries, but they're not driving this dysfunctional situation.
Well, they're certainly... They're part of the system,
mm-hmm.
and they're extremely influential in the system on Capitol Hill with the bureaucracy and with both in uniform and not in uniform in the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
They're a major actor in the system, but if we had people in uniform and in suits in the Pentagon who were serious about their jobs rather than worrying about the politics of their jobs and had a good grounding in what works in combat and what doesn't, and had the discipline to impose on the system, here's what we're going to do. If you're going to help, that's good. If you're not going to help, I'm going to get you out of the way. We don't have that kind of system in the Pentagon today. And the people surrounding President-elect Obama on the future Pentagon have every appearance of not being the kind of people we need. They have a track record, and their track record is not a particularly admirable one during the Clinton years. There's some things I like about Secretary of Defense Gates. He had the character and the insight to fire some senior people for some incredibly bad work they had been doing, Secretary of the Army, Secretary of the Air Force, Chief of Staff of the Air Force, in the latter cases, some double dealing they were involved in on politics and in Capitol Hill behind the back of the Secretary of Defense. That's the good news. The bad news is he only fired three people. There's lots more people in that building who have no business, given their track record, doing the job they're doing.
And just in closing, in the last 30 seconds, the fact that, that we're going broke, is that going to give Obama any leverage to clean house?
It should. The financial meltdown and our economic problems are going to put a huge amount of pressure on the Pentagon budget. It's already out of proportion to what it should be. There's two ways of dealing with how to make the Pentagon budget more sensible. If we keep using the same thinking that we've had for decades, less money is the worst of both worlds. It'll accelerate all of these negative forces. If people start making the right kinds of decisions based on the right set of data, we can have a much better national defense, much more relevant, much more effective, much more lean and mean at a hugely significant smaller amount of money.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles today, Winslow Wheeler.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Thanks again. Again, Winslow Wheeler works on national security issues for 31 years in the Pentagon and at the General Accounting Office and with the Senate Budget Committee. I'd like to thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.